Chick Webb in a 1934 recording of Blue Minor. Mondays at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air, we feature the musical stage with John Johnson. Today on part 3 of a 6-part series on the musicals of Rodgers and Hart, we'll hear songs from Evergreen, Jumbo, and On Your Toes. Fresh Air's arts reviewer Judy Stein will be with us at 3:40 for her weekly review of museum and gallery shows around town. And at 3:30, Dan Lusk reviews another publication from the small literary press on Off the Wall. Many children whose parents raised them, according to Dr. Spock, are now parents themselves and consult the revised edition of Spock for the raising of their own children. At 3 o'clock, we'll hear the famous baby and child care expert, and we'll also hear from his son, who says that his father used to seem more relaxed with the babies of his patients than he did with his own son. These interviews with Dr. Benjamin Spock and his son Michael Spock were recorded for the Options in Education series. Fertility awareness is the study of the physical signs and changes in a woman's body that indicate when she's fertile. A woman can use this information about her fertile periods to help in contraception or conception. Kay Whitlock and Regina Pfeiffer, who are currently writing a book on fertility awareness, are also teaching classes on the subject at the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women. We'll discuss fertility awareness with them in about a half hour. I'd like to read you the opening of Margaret Robinson's new novel, which is called Arrivals and Departure. One winter day, Sophie got up to go to work. On the counter by the sink was a note in Tim's big square printing. He wrote everything in all caps. When he first moved in, Tim told her that for 5 years he wrote in all small letters, like E.E. Cummings. Then he changed to all caps. She read the note. Heading for the coast, it's been terrific. As the novel continues, Sophie realizes that now that she's single, she's going to have to confront how undeveloped her sense of identity is and how fuzzy she is about what she wants for herself. Many stories which start with a woman whose lover has just walked out climax with the discovery of a new, more mature romance. There are some pleasant and unpleasant encounters with men in this book, but no big romance to save the day. The novel isn't about radical change, but about the gradual growth of a working woman on her own, trying to create a balance between her professional life and her personal needs, at the same time as she has to try to learn what those personal needs are. Arrivals and Departures is Margaret Robinson's first novel, and it's published by Scribner's. Her stories, short stories, have been published in Red Book, the Saturday Evening Post, and Cosmopolitan. She reviews books for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has written feature stories for the Today magazine, including a story about Fresh Air. She has an article about Philadelphia in the current issue of Red Book. Margaret lives in Swarthmore and teaches at Widener. Margaret Robinson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Since you've written short stories as well as novels, I'd like to know how you can tell the difference when you get an idea about the idea of this going to be a novel and the one that will be a short story.
Well, I think when I started writing Arrivals and Departures, I didn't really know whether I had an idea for a novel. The origin was a short story, and I liked the character in the story. I liked the tone of voice that had evolved for me in writing that story. And because I was intrigued with the style of it and the tone of it, I wanted to go on. I wanted to know more about that woman and find out really over a broader length of time what she was like and what her life would be. And I simply began in a sort of exploratory way. And the story kind of pulls you along. You know, you don't quite know where you're going, but as you write, what you have written leads you to the next place. I don't know if that's the way most people write novels, but that's the way this one got written.
I think anybody reading the novel who didn't know you would expect you to walk through the door as a person who's the same age as the woman in your book, since a lot of people assume that novels are basically autobiographical. But you write about women of different ages. And do you have to make sure you're always in touch with people of different ages so that you know what their personal histories are like and what records they listen to and what restaurants they hang out at and all these details that you need to write a convincing book?
Well, writers are nosy. They're curious, and they like knowing lots of people. I know I like knowing many different kinds of people and people of different ages. I think writers also have very good memories, and they draw upon what they read and what they observe and what they've experienced and what they remember. So I find that I like to write about people of all kinds of ages and backgrounds.
Is there anything you do to help that memory?
Well, I keep a journal, And I try to use that as a regular place to write every day, where I record and observe and report and dream and imagine and fantasize. And it's kind of a place where there's a lot of raw material. It's kind of like, for a runner, it's your daily exercise. You're keeping in trim. And then when I'm ready to do a piece of work, often in the journal I'll find that there's a germ of something. Sometimes there'll be an entire story. Sometimes there'll just be little bits, little pieces of dialogue that you hear on the train or, you know, whatever. And those bits and pieces will help to form a character or an incident or the beginning of a conflict in a story, almost the way you take pieces and form a mosaic, that kind of technique.
Do you keep your journals hidden?
No. No, they sit right out on my desk, and I don't feel terribly private about them. Nobody in my family, I live with six other people, and nobody has ever pressed me about them or threatened to read them. Or
maybe now they'll start.
Well, I don't feel particularly nervous about my journal. It's just a place where I can record things, and I find it's a useful activity, both personally, for my personal development, and as a writer, I find it invaluable.
As I mentioned before, your book starts with a woman whose lover has just walked out on her, and she gets the goodbye note that morning when she wakes up. And as I read the book, I kept wondering if she was going to find another romance and end up in a more mature romance, and she doesn't. And the book ends up not being about that. I mean, she has her mild-mannered encounters, but that's about as far as it goes. Was that a conscious decision to keep the big romance out of this story?
Yes, it was. I've read a number of books, and I'm sure you have too, where the beginning is essentially like the beginning of my book. It begins with the end of something, the end of a marriage, the end of a long affair, and a woman is suddenly found on her own and having to re-examine a lot of things and figure out a lot of things. I felt as though I didn't want to have the traditional happy ending. I didn't want to have the traditional sexual acting out, which I think often is a result of the end of something. What I was interested in was a woman's own inner resources and how she could draw on the strengths that were already in her, already in her life, and also the accidental things that kind of happen to people and happen to her. And, of course, the big thing that happens into her life is the dog in the story. But not just that. I mean, things that happen at work and just the ordinary daily stuff, which she is able to use to somehow probe and develop and help herself through the pain of the separation, but help herself to grow, too.
Yeah, the dog does play a very important role. It's a dog who she's named Dog, and who becomes her good friend. She even has a dream of of them having an encounter together, and she realizes that she wants a companion. Did you have a dog or a pet that this relationship was modeled after in any way? Do you know people who are that close with their pet and live alone?
You mentioned autobiography. Writers take little pieces, as I was saying before, from all kinds of places in order to form characters and develop plots. For me, I think the one truly autobiographical element in this novel is the dog, because I do have a dog, and the dog in the book is very much like the dog that I have at home. He didn't come into my life in the same way that this dog comes into Sophie's life, but in behavior and appearance, I'm afraid that dog is my dog.
Well, I guess you don't have to encounter your dog reading the novel and having to confront whether he feels he's been accurately portrayed.
Right.
Let me read you a quote that I'm sure you've already read, and it's from the review of Edna Stump's review in the Philadelphia Inquirer of your book, and she writes, Robinson is in a strong tradition created by women writers, represented by contemporary Anne Tyler, and going directly back to Sophie's heroine, Jane Austen. Do you feel a part of that tradition, Margaret?
Well, I think it's a wonderful tradition to be in. I was delighted with what Edna had to say. Jane Austen has been one of my heroines for a long time. I've read and reread her work for years. Anne Tyler I don't know as well. I have read several of her novels, and some of her short stories too, but I don't know her work as well. But I feel that yes, it's good company. I'm glad to be included. And I think that what Edna's talking about there is the capacity, the tendency, maybe is a better word, of these two women writers to focus on the daily events and to find meaning in them rather than, moving off into a bigger landscape and exterior material. There's a lot of focus on the inner world and on the small landscape where everything is observed with great detail. And I feel that fits me. That's appropriate.
Is that what you find exciting about Jane Austen's writing?
Yes. Yes. It's wonderful that she could do what she did, given the constraints of her life.
Did you find that you had a different reaction to her work when you were in school, like, say, high school?
I hated her.
Uh-huh.
In high school.
Yeah.
Did you try to read her in high school?
Yeah, but I unfortunately have not gotten the chance to make that second big leap with her.
Well, I remember my mother thrusting Pride and Prejudice at me when I was maybe 16, and partly because it was my mother thrusting it, and partly because I just couldn't connect. I would have none of it, and I didn't discover Jane Austen until much later. And I don't think I've come to realize what a truly powerful writer she is until very recently.
Can I ask you to read a selection from your new novel?
Oh, I'd like to.
Well, let me reintroduce you first for our listeners just joining us. I'm speaking with Philadelphia-based writer Margaret Robinson, and her new novel has just been published by Scribner's. It's the first novel, and it's called Arrivals and Departures, and she's going to read a selection from it for us.
The scene that I'm going to read involves some characters that I perhaps ought to introduce. Sophie is the main character, and Lois is her friend. Alan is Lois's boyfriend, who has been a boyfriend sort of off stage and now has suddenly showed up in town, which is quite a new experience for Lois because Alan in person is different from Alan over the phone. And Sophie is going out to meet Alan. And then toward the end of the passage, Marie is mentioned. Marie is Sophie's student and a student she's very fond of. And Joe is mentioned, and Joe is Marie's boyfriend. And the fact of Marie's seizure is mentioned, and I think it's important to know that Marie has epilepsy. This selection has interested me because, unlike lots of writing that I do where I'm really kind of being led by the material and I don't always know where I'm going and it's a very groping kind of activity, with this scene I knew I was in trouble with Alan because I knew I didn't like him and I knew Sophie didn't like him. And I remembered having been told by many writing teachers that you must find some saving grace in any character you're writing about. So that was an issue. I had to do something about not liking Alan and about Sophie's not liking him. And I also had in mind, for some reason, when I was working on this, I think it was Samuel Johnson's admonition to the young writer, which was, astonish me, surprise me. So I had those things really quite in mind, which is not my usual way of proceeding, but that was on my mind when I was working on this scene. Sophie met Lois and Alan at a beef and brew for dinner. Meat and malt, turf and surf, moo and whistle, paddock and haddock. Sophie couldn't keep them all straight. They were all dark and smoky. She could never see the food, and they made her hair and clothes stink. A society of perfume and deodorant users, and nobody worried about smoke odor. Something your best friend wouldn't tell you. Even Lifebuoy could not stop S.O. They were all the same, checkered tablecloths, red napkins, breadsticks in baskets, salad bars, onion soup made with bouillon cubes, 50 cents extra for the Roquefort dressing. Happy hour on Thursday afternoons from 5 to 7, everyone slurping down plates of raw beef full of insecticides and steroids and smacking their lips. Walking into a beef and brew was like entering Plato's cave, shadows and illusions everywhere being taken for the real thing. Today, Sophie planned to have a whiskey sour right away quick, and never mind the dye and the lemon peel. The whiskey sour would put her under fast. And then she'd order the prime ribs, rare, a baked potato wrapped in aluminum foil, and a salad with Roquefort dressing. 50 cents extra, big spender. Sophie wanted to like Alan and have a good time, whatever that meant. She was losing her faith in having a good time. Since Tim had left, she was discovering that some of her best times were when she was alone. But it was Friday night, and she was up for a little cutting loose. With Sophie, one whiskey sour went a long way. The yearbook was done, though final exams and term papers weren't. The senior folderol was still in the works, picnics and parties and proms and parades. Last year she swore never again, but she was helping plan it all. Filling herself up, mothering. It would soon be over. Never again. This time she meant it. She got in the Pinto, not locking the doors. Marie always locked the doors. My aunt had a friend whose door flew open on the throughway. She was bounced out of the car into the path of an oncoming car. I had a friend, Sophie had replied, who had a friend who got trapped in the car after an accident. The doors were locked and he couldn't get out fast enough. The car exploded. Sophie did not lock the doors. She had decided she preferred being bounced out to being exploded. Driving to the Beef and Brew, Sophie wondered about Alan. Would he be Mr. Wright for Lois? Mr. Wright, if you think he is? Mr. This'll Do? Mr. Wright was like innocence, dead as a crow in the road, but always rising from the ditch in fresh new feathers. Or were those cerements? It was hard to tell. He was always careful to spring up in the dark with the light behind him. Which reminded Sophie of the time she and Tim were coming home from the shore, driving up from South Jersey, which felt like Georgia, slow and hot and sandy, complete with a sharp dichotomy between the lives of blacks and whites. Flat land, groves of trees, fields of squashes and peppers and tomatoes, irrigation systems shooting out high sprays, water glistening on the leafy soybeans, split melons, orange and pink, at the roadside stands. They were driving back from the shore at dusk when Tim hit a bird. They were taking the back roads, enjoying the bright butterfly weed by the road, the musky smells of the fields. Tim had slowed down for every crow in the road, the way he always did, and they always flew off with miles of room to spare. Then he had heard the honking of a flock of Canadian geese. He was looking for the high, straggling V overhead. They were both distracted by the idea, on this late summer evening, that fall was already on the way. Tim didn't break for the next crow. Heavy with worms, it didn't flap away in time. He hit it. A soft thump on the front of the car, a flutter of black feathers barely visible out the rear window. Tim pulled over and got out to make sure it was completely dead, to put the body in the woods so it wouldn't be mashed lying in the road. He talked about it all the way home. Sophie pulled the Pinto into a parking space at the Beef and Brew. She hoped Alan was a good guy. He had an okay name. Her dentist, who went hiking and told Sophie about Frostline equipment as opposed to North Face, he was up on all the details, an informed consumer. His name was Alan. He was thinking about pine forests at dawn while he was drilling the decay out of Sophie's molars. It was a good name, Alan. A-L-A-N, as in lad. A-L-L-E-N. Sophie, because she was a crank, preferred A-L-L-E-N. Through this haze of smoke, she saw Lois and Alan at a corner table. Alan stood up and offered his hand. "Hey, how you doing?" he said. Nasal voice, heavy-set body, short-clipped hair, of an indeterminate shade of brown, pale blue eyes. Sophie shook his hand and sat down. "Sophie," Lois said nervously, "this is Alan." "Hello, Alan," Sophie said. Well, that was over with. But the galvanic skin response was negative. She was getting like Dog, who liked almost everybody on sight, but sometimes had his moments of irrational growling, which Sophie had come to trust. If Dog growled at someone at the door, when he wagged at 99 out of 100, Sophie didn't let the person in. A part of her was growling at Alan. She had the horrible feeling that before the evening was over, he was going to call someone either a nigger or a fag. But the evening went along just fine. Alan turned out to be A-L-L-E-N. Over their drinks and roast beef, Lois told about introducing him to her parents. "My mother thinks he's cute." "Your mother's cute," said Alan. "My father slapped him on the back." Your father's all right. If I look that good at his age, I'll be happy. Alan talked about his divorce. I was never home. My wife was miserable. No kids, thank God. I've been telling Lois that my work comes first. It's high pressure, and it really pays, and it comes first. They were waiting for their coffee. Alan took a bottle of Cremolin out of his pocket, tossed a couple into his mouth, and chewed them. What's your wife doing now? Sophie asked. She opened a boutique, works 70 hours a week, really getting into it, really liberated, and hauling in the dough. That's not my idea of being liberated, Sophie said. It's no good if women just switch their crap for men's crap. Of course, said Alan. It's not good if women lose their tenderness and their femininity. He looked at Lois, who was looking at Sophie. I'd like to see men have a chance to develop their tenderness, said Sophie. No room for that in my job, Alan laughed. You teachers, you can indulge in that sort of stuff. But with me, it's strictly scientific. Every day, hundreds of lives depend on my judgment. No room for error, no place for tenderness. He burped. His pie arrived, and their three cups of coffee. Are you up for a movie, Soph? Asked Lois, changing the subject. I'd like to see Julia. Not me, said Alan, lighting into his pie. I heard it's about a couple of dykes. Woof! Sophie was woofing, digging her paws into the ground, grabbing hold of Alan's pants leg. A few more inches and she'd have her fangs in his calf. Oh, no, Lois said firmly. Oh, no, it's about the Nazis, about Lillian Hellman getting money into Nazi Germany for her friend Julia to help people escape. Sophie considered tipping over the table, as Hellman had done. She had heard Hellman read Julia. Hellman in her 70s with bright blonde hair and a long, shocking pink gown and a face like an eagle's. Hellman erect and unsparing, reading Julia in a voice that never cracked or wavered, though finally tears began to run down her face. Hellman was one of Sophie's heroes. I read it was about this thing one woman had for the other, Alan persisted stubbornly, and I can't stand dykes. A friendship, said Sophie, a loyalty to a friend. Julia's obsession is with justice. Lillian is obsessed with loyalty to a friend, whom she loves partly because of the friend's obsession with justice. She could see Alan was unconvinced. She was wishing she had had two whiskey sours when the sound of gagging, loud and painful, came from the table next to theirs. Sophie looked over and saw a middle-aged woman with a bulging scarlet face. The gagging sound had stopped, and the woman was flapping her hands, trying to struggle to her feet, turning even redder. She couldn't breathe. Before Sophie could figure out what to do, Alan was on his feet behind the woman, his arms wrapped around her ample body, hands in a fist jabbing up and into her diaphragm. A piece of meat popped out of the woman's mouth onto the table. Water squirted out of her eyes. Her glasses landed in her plate in a puddle of gravy. She inhaled raggedly, coughed, then inhaled again. Already her color was returning to normal, and she was fumbling for a hanky and trying to retrieve her glasses out of her mashed potatoes. I don't know how to thank you, a fat man in a blue suit was saying to Alan, wringing his hand while the rest of the people at the table laughed with relief and clapped Alan on the back and took the woman to the restroom to tidy herself. Quick thinking, the Heimlich hug, a few more minutes and she'd have been gone, people were saying, and the restaurant owner, or at least that's who he seemed to be, came over and congratulated Alan as well. The woman returned from the ladies' room composed and gave Alan a big kiss, whereupon she started to cry. More laughter. The fat man tried to order Alan, Lois, and Sophie a round of drinks, but Alan managed to refuse without hurting anyone's feelings and to retreat to their table again. Finally, the hubbub died down. They looked at each other. Alan was embarrassed. Lois was proud. Sophie was dumbfounded. The woman choking had made her think of Marie's seizure, the way Marie's head had lolled and bumped, the way she was beyond reaching. Marie was being a fool about her medication. Joe had talked to her. Sophie had talked to her. They had done what they could. At least the seizures couldn't kill her. Alan, she said, you saved that woman's life.
Margaret Robinson reading a selection from her new novel called Arrivals and Departures. Well, when I read it, I find that my feelings about him changed. I still figured I probably would, like Sophie, not find him the most terrific dinner companion, but there's some admiration and respect that you develop for someone when they've just saved the person at the next table's life. Do you think that suggestion that, who was it who said to you that, a writing teacher, that when you develop a character you have to find something that you like about them? Is that always true, Morgan?
Well, I never write the kind of thing where you have an out-and-out villain. There is writing of that kind. You read fairy tales, and you have a wicked stepmother, and there's nothing nice about her. But in the kind of work that I do, I think that you do have to see a whole person, and you do want to see things from that person's point of view. And once you get into the character's skin, of course you're going to find some saving graces, some attractive characteristics. So I think that for me, it's good advice. It may not be true for everybody.
This Arrivals and Departures is your first novel. What does it? What did you have to do to see it through, to navigate from the manuscript to the published novel now available in bookstores? What were some of the intervening factors?
I think mostly I had to be patient. It takes a long time. It took a long time for me, at any rate. I wrote the story that the novel grew out of in 1977. I then did a first draft of the novel, mostly to see if I could do it, and for the reasons that I mentioned, because I was interested in the character, and I particularly was drawn by the voice, the voice in which the novel is told, which was a new voice for me and was something that pulled me into storytelling. After I had done a first draft, I set it aside and actually did a draft of another novel. Then I went back and revised the Sophie book. And then I sent it to my agent, who sent it around for a year in New York as part of a story collection with the short novel sort of as a package. And it took a year before we had an offer on it. And then it was not for the entire collection. It was just for the novel.
Were you surprised that that was what
no,
the offer was?
No, not really, because story collections are very hard to place. So I really wasn't surprised. And I was pleased to have the novel accepted. But then I needed to do more revisions. And
did you agree with the changes that were suggested, if anywhere?
Well, interestingly enough, the changes were almost entirely cuts. I don't mean cuts of individual words or sentences, but cuts of really whole characters, whole scenes. The woman that I worked with at Scribner's, I think, had a vision of the book as a very spare, moving forward in one direction. She told me at one point that she wanted to leave out anything that didn't seem fresh to her. And anything that was not original and strong, she would say, well, this is all very well. For example, I wrote a bunch of material about Sophie's parents. I had a scene where Sophie goes up to visit her father on his birthday. And there's all sorts of dialogue and interaction between her and her family. And my editor said, well, that's all very well, but it's all been done. You haven't said anything new. You haven't told me anything about Sophie I don't already know. Let's just leave that out. So I felt that she brought a clarity of vision to the book that I, as the writer, couldn't have. Because I get terribly involved, and I don't have much judgment. And this woman was very helpful, I felt.
Do you go to bookstores now looking to see if they have it in?
Well, when it first came out, I didn't dare. I was afraid it wouldn't be there. But I recently went into a store near where I live, and my husband and I had gone to this shopping mall for some other reason. And we walked by a bookstore, and he said, oh, let's go in and see if it's there. And I said, oh, I don't want to. But he dragged me in, and there were three racks of new fiction, and it wasn't on the first or the second, but it was on the third, right next to all the, you know, bestsellers. So I was delighted.
Good. You've written short stories for Cosmopolitan, Red Book, and Saturday Evening Post. Is there any kind of guidelines that you get sent before you submit a short story? Do they each have an almost code that describes what kind of subject matter they're interested in, what kind of style they expect the story to be written in?
Well, yes and no. Any writer who submits a story, say, to Redbook or asks for their guidelines will get a printed sheet describing the kinds of things that they are interested in hearing about in their fiction. I haven't tended to pay a whole lot of attention to that. And in fact, when I sit down to write a story, it's because there's a story that is in my mind that I need to write, or there's something I want to explore and perhaps it will turn into a story, or there's some kind of voice that's given me sentences that I record and then I go on from there. And I don't really worry too much about where I'm going to send it when I'm done. Then when it's finished, I do send things out, of course, and sometimes they get published, sometimes they don't. So yes, there are guidelines, but my feeling is that it's wise not to get too concerned with them. I've had stories in Redbook that are about subjects which are supposedly taboos. And in fact,
what are those?
Well, I wrote a story about a couple who couldn't have children. You mentioned later in the show you're going to have some people talk about fertility. Well, that seems to be a bigger and bigger issue these days, with many women postponing the time when they will have children. And I wrote a short story about one couple's struggle to have a child, and there is no happy ending to that either. They don't succeed. Well, I didn't think that was exactly would be the proper thing, but it was published. And I've written a number of stories about old people, and I've written about death. I've written about infants that have been born prematurely and died. For me, it's important to write about what I need to write about and worry about the other stuff later.
Right. Well, I want to wish you good luck with your future writing, and it's been really nice to talk with you on the air, Margaret. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Margaret Robinson is a Philadelphia-based writer, and her writing appears in a number of magazines. She's got a story on Philadelphia that's in the current issue of Redbook. She's written for the Inquirer's Today magazine. Her book reviews appear frequently on the Sunday book review page. And her first novel has just been published by Scribner's. It's called Arrivals and Departures. Thanks again for talking with us about it, Margaret. It's 24 minutes to 3, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. And as Margaret just mentioned, in a few minutes we'll be hearing a discussion on fertility awareness, which is basically the study of figuring out what kind of signs a woman's body has to let you know when you're in a fertile period. So that's coming up in just a couple of minutes. This is a duet with Jimmy Rowles and guitarist Joe Pass. Thank you. It was Tis Autumn, and we heard Jimmy Rouse at the piano and Joe Pass on guitar. It's 19 minutes to 3. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to hear an interview with Dr. Benjamin Spock, the famous baby doctor, and his son Michael Spock, and they'll be talking about their relationship with one another. And Michael Spock says in the discussion that he used to think that his father was more comfortable around the babies of his clients than he was around his own son. That's coming up in about 20 minutes. Then at 3:30, Dan Loskin, Off the Wall, our weekly review of the Small Literary Press. At 3:40, Judy Stein reviews museum and gallery shows. And at 4 o'clock, it's part 3 of John Johnson's series on the musicals of Rodgers and Hart. Women who want to prevent conception usually use birth control all the time, even though they're only fertile during part of the cycle. But since the rhythm method has proved to be unreliable in determining when a woman's fertile, women have to assume that they're always fertile. Well, coming up, we're going to hear about new developments in fertility awareness that may help women determine when their fertile periods are, and then they can use this information either for conception or for contraception. I spoke with Kay Whitlock and Regina Pfeiffer recently. They both teach fertility awareness classes at the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women, and they're writing a book on the subject, which is scheduled for publication by Prentice Hall in 1982. Kay Whitlock and Regina Pfeiffer work at a local family planning agency where they have developed a pilot fertility awareness program. A new series of their fertility awareness courses will begin on January 18th at Blackwell, and I'll give more information about those sessions a little later. When I spoke with them, I asked Kay first how women use fertility awareness.
Well, women use it for different reasons. Some use it as a contraceptive resource, either as a sole method of contraception or in conjunction with barrier birth control methods. Some women use it to plan a pregnancy, to identify the time when they're maximally fertile. And some women want to learn it just to learn more about their own bodies and to learn it as a body of knowledge that helps inform them about gynecological health care in general.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of different techniques that you're going to be teaching. Do you want to describe them, Rich?
Yes. Basically, we teach two systems. We teach a system of evaluating cervical mucus, which is the mucus which is secreted by the cervix and flows down through the vagina and appears at the opening of the vagina. What is known as a symptothermal method, which is symptoms of the cervical mucus and some other signs of fertility that occur, and thermal meaning temperature, a temperature change that occurs in a fertile woman during the menstrual cycle. We basically teach cervical mucus method and symptothermal methods.
Now, Evelyn Billings, who is someone who's done a lot of research into the method with the cervical mucus, was on the show a few months ago and tried to describe the method. It's perhaps a little difficult to understand completely on the air, but what's the premise that it's based on, Kay? Why does the mucus change?
Well, the mucus changes in response to changing levels of the hormone estrogen that is produced and secreted by a woman's ovaries during her menstrual cycle. At the beginning of a cycle, that is when she begins her menstrual period, the estrogen levels are low, and building up towards the time of ovulation or release of the egg from the ovary, estrogen levels rise. And as the estrogen levels become higher, any cervical mucus that's being produced becomes wet and clear and exhibits those characteristics that we would call fertile cervical mucus. That mucus is necessary for sperm to survive in. If a woman ovulates but doesn't have wet cervical mucus, she can't get pregnant. So we're looking at cervical mucus as it changes in response to changing estrogen levels, and we can identify a range of time during each cycle when a woman is fertile by looking at the kind of mucus she's secreting.
Was this recently discovered?
No, not at all. Evelyn Billings and her husband, John Billings, did most of the work in this in the 50s and continued it through the 60s and the 70s, and it's really taken the rest of the world till now, the 80s, to catch up with them and their research. Basically, infertility researchers have known about this for a long time, but it's taken a long time to sift down to the general public. It still isn't there, but there is some information now.
Would you feel safe if you were trying to avoid pregnancy? Would you feel safe using this cervical mucus method, or even using it in conjunction with the temperature method? Is that enough protection?
Oh, absolutely. As a sole method of birth control, its theoretical effectiveness certainly is right up there with you know, the other sort of technological birth control methods, including chemical methods and barrier methods, pill and the diaphragm. It can be just about as effective as those if a woman follows the rules of evaluation of her fertile time and either uses some form of barrier birth control method or abstains from sexual intercourse during her potentially fertile time. It's very highly effective if people use it consistently and correctly each time. If they don't, a possible pregnancy could result, just as with every other form of birth control.
How foolproof is it? I mean, how much can you really tell which kind of mucus you have?
Most women can tell very well. I think initially, for the first 2 or 3 or 4 cycles of learning to observe it, it's difficult. It's confusing. What is tacky mucus? What is wet fluid mucus? What are dry days kinds of things? It's very difficult in the beginning to learn, but each woman has her own individual pattern, and within a few cycles, she begins to understand what that is for herself, and that's not going to change. Mm-hmm. It's basically going to stay the same, and then it becomes relatively easy to understand.
I know that when Evelyn Billings was here, she said that she would not recommend using the mucus method in conjunction with any other form of birth control, particularly the diaphragm, because the cream or jelly that you're using in conjunction with it would mix with the cervical mucus and make it impossible to judge what the mucus was like. So what do you think?
Well, contraceptive residues can confuse a woman's mucus reading. However, it's not impossible for a woman to tell the difference. It's very difficult for beginners to learn to tell the difference, but after time, you can learn to distinguish contraceptive residue from a cervical mucus secretion. I think it's also important to point out that within the whole area of fertility awareness and natural family planning, that there are different schools of thought on whether other forms of contraception besides just using one of the natural methods, whether any other methods are acceptable. And some of the schools of thought, of which Evelyn Billings belongs to, hold that no other form of contraception is all right. We prefer to let women make that distinction for themselves. If they want to use it as a sole method, fine. With barrier methods, fine. They can learn to do that quite effectively, too.
Why are you interested in these methods? Are you trying to avoid the chemicals of the spermicidals or the pill?
No. No, that's not at all how we got into it. I think our interest was really one, well, let me speak for me personally. I was working in the family planning field for a number of years and doing some healthcare delivery and some educational programs about contraception, about women's healthcare. And I was a couple of years into this before I discovered this information myself. And at that time, I was 26 years old. I'd been in the field a number of years, and I said, this is bizarre. How come I have never heard of this? And I began to understand that, the mucus, the temperature, the menstrual cycle. And from that, developed programming where the emphasis was on helping women to learn this information and to use it or not use it as they saw, and to integrate it into their own lives for pregnancy planning or contraception or to understand menopause, whatever was important to them.
Is that similar to your reasons, Kay?
Oh, sure. I think it's just a whole information base about our bodies that we should have had all along as women, and we haven't had all along. So there's was certainly tremendous excitement for me when I started working with Reg in 1978 on this. And it's just sort of seems to carry over into all areas of health. It's exciting to see the women in the workshops kind of begin to understand all the different applications.
A couple of years ago, I remember hearing that there was going to be, I think it was called an ovulometer, some kind of very precise thermometer that would be used to measure a woman's temperature for fertility awareness. How much progress has been made in that device?
Well, there are a lot of different devices that are in different stages of development, some of which are on the market. There's supposed to be a little wristwatch that flashes yes or no, according to whether a woman's in her fertile period, to tell her whether she can have unprotected sexual intercourse or not. There are things called ovutimers that are supposed to measure the thickness of the cervical mucus produced. All of these gadgets so far are very imprecise and should not be relied upon by a woman who is wanting to know if she can have unprotected sexual intercourse if she wants to avoid pregnancy. We cannot tell without directly observing the ovary precisely the precise moment at which a woman ovulates. What we can tell is a range of time during which she is potentially fertile. That has to do with timing of ovulation, egg life, sperm life, and a number of different factors. So to say that a little gadget is going to tell you yes or no, you're fertile at this minute, is misleading. Mm-hmm. And I hope women approach those kinds of gadgets with a healthy skepticism.
This is a question that I think everyone's confused about the answer to. Now that you've done a lot of research on fertility, can you get pregnant when you're menstruating? Because I know that's a time when a lot of women keep their birth control in the closet and don't bother with it, because after all, they're menstruating.
Yes.
You can.
Yes, it is possible. Although unlikely, it is possible. Firstly, it depends on how erratic or how short your menstrual cycles are. Women with short or erratic menstrual cycles, especially adolescent women, will have a greater chance of getting pregnant during their periods.
Why is that?
Well, because the shorter the cycle, kind of the earlier you ovulate. And if you would have a cycle that would be 20, 21 days long, you would theoretically ovulate 14 to 16 days back from that time period. And if you have longer menstrual flows, you know, flows that last 5, 6, 7, 8 days, sure, you could ovulate during the time of your bleeding. But it is highly unlikely that a woman's going to get pregnant before the 6th day of her cycle.
However, I think Reg brought up an important point, that I think there's a kind of myth out there about mid-cycle ovulation, that for every woman she ovulates, some right around the middle of her cycle, and that ovulation generally happens on day 14. That's sort of based on the myth of the tidy, perfect 28-day cycle. Only about 6% of women actually consistently have 28-day menstrual cycles. Also, as Reg mentioned, ovulation is really going to happen about 12 to 16 days from the end of a cycle, not from the beginning. And if you think about that then with the short cycle and what that means when you would be ovulating, you could see, number one, it's not mid-cycle. It's toward the front of the cycle. And if you do have a long menstrual flow, you could ovulate right then. But I think it's important to clear up that myth that mid-cycle ovulation does not hold true for all women, and that we count back 12 to 16 days from the end of a menstrual cycle.
How reliable is that?
It's real reliable.
Except that you only know that in retrospect.
Right.
You can define once your cycle has ended. You never know how long your cycle is going to be. But in the end, you can go back and count the 12 to 16 days and really define the time period in which you were fertile. So it's no help to you as you're going through it. That's why what is important is to learn to observe, you know, the physical signs, the changing mucus and the change in the temperature.
If any of our listeners enroll in the class that you'll be teaching at the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center, what can they expect? What's a class going to be like, and how will people learn to tell their own bodily signs?
Well, it's held in three sessions, and it's held in a kind of informal support group fashion. We help each woman recognize her own fertility pattern. We provide a whole overview of what the changing signs are and teach women all of the general principles about that, give them all of the information that we can, and then we provide individualized assistance. Reg, would you like to add anything?
Well, I think what is really exciting for Kay and I is that the women come with all different perspectives. Some are interested in learning this for contraception. Some are interested in understanding what's happening with their infertility studies. Some are interested in understanding about what's happening as they're entering menopause, premenopause. So that's real exciting for us. You know, there are so many different reasons, and it makes the environment really positive. I mean, there's lots of support and sharing. We have small groups of about 10 women who are in the groups, and it's a very nice learning atmosphere.
Okay, and what does someone need to register?
Well, what do they need to do? All they need to do is call the Elizabeth Blackwell Health Center for Women at 563-7577 and ask about the fertility awareness stuff. We'll get them some fact sheets and forms and provide them with any answers to any immediate questions that they have about the courses.
Great. Okay, I want to thank you both for describing this.
Thank you, Terry.
Great. Thank you, Terry.
I was speaking with Kay Whitlock and Regina Pfeiffer, and they're both teaching fertility awareness sessions. They're writing a book on the subject that's due for publication in 1982 by Prentice Hall. Let me give you that information again. They'll be holding a series that starts on January 18th at the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women in Center City, and then a second series that starts February 1st. This is Monday night classes, and for any more information, you can call 563-7577. Again, that's 563-7577. By the way, fertility awareness will be the subject of this Sunday's edition of the Health Connection with Dr. Howard Posner. So the hour from 7 until 8 o'clock this Sunday will also be devoted to a discussion of fertility awareness. It's 2 minutes to 3, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a few minutes, we'll be listening to an interview with Dr. Benjamin Spock and his son, Michael Spock, recorded for the Options in Education series. This is a 1959 recording featuring the late singer Helen Humes. The song is called You Can Depend on Me.
Though you say we're through, has made you forget, you know, you
Helen Humes, from an album called Tain't Nobody's Business If I Do, just reissued on Contemporary Records. 3:02 is the time, and this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. A reminder, in an hour, on this week's edition of The Musical Stage, we'll be featuring part 3 of a 6-part series on the musicals of Rodgers and Hart. Dr. Benjamin Spock's advice has been followed by more than one generation of parents. Many of the parents consulting Spock now were themselves brought up by the book. So you may have wondered how Dr. Spock brought up his own son, Michael, and what kind of relationship they had to one another and what kind of relationship they have now. Dr. Benjamin Spock and Michael Spock were recently interviewed for the NPR Options in Education series, and from the Options in Education archives, let's hear that interview.
Suppose your baby's been doing that off and on all night. What's wrong? She stops when you pick her up. She doesn't need new diapers. What's wrong? And what on earth is wrong with your 8-year-old, forgetting everything, acting so absent-minded? Well, since 1946, lots of American parents have turned to the same place for answers to these and other questions about babies and children. They turn to Baby and Child Care by Dr. Benjamin Spock.
One of the nice things about the book is that the index is so complete that for any possible problem, parent could run into, it's indexed. For instance, crying as 1, 2, 3, 4. Crying is about a half a page, and it talks about crying from this, crying from that. It's just, you know, it's amazing. You don't have to use your imagination to figure out where to look it up. It just addresses the problem.
When I was raising my children, we all moved away from our parents and our grandparents, and we were isolated, and we couldn't pick up the phone and say, what do I do now? Oh, Johnny or Mary is doing such and such, and I don't know how to handle it. So the first thing you would think of would be Dr. Spock, because everything was very concise, and he was the substitute grandmother that wasn't there to help us.
I think every new mother, especially the first time around, turns to Dr. Spock. I really think so. I think he's the first person you think of when you think of babies.
He's the subject of this profile. I'm John Merrow for NPR's Options in Education. I talked with Benjamin Spock recently about the idea that he, through his book, has been father to a couple of generations of American kids.
Well, I love the compliment of people saying that I brought up a whole generation. I think that's a tremendous exaggeration.
It's not always a compliment. You know that, of course.
Well, I know that. I think some people think that the younger generation are all fiends and scoundrels, and they really think of me as the Pied Piper that's misled a whole generation. I think that's a big exaggeration, too. I think, in general, that kids are good. I would be proud to have contributed to the upbringing of a majority of them. I think a majority of them are thoughtful. I think a majority of them are hardworking. I think a majority of them are reasonably idealistic. But, you know, in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, kids were highly politicized, and many of them were quite radical, and a lot of them were activists. And those kids were brought up, presumably, on my book, and that's what led to the criticism that I'd corrupted a whole generation on the part of those people who not only didn't like the opposition to the war in Vietnam of these kids, but didn't like their hippie hairdos and their hippie clothing. Now you've got children who are much more conformist. There's very little activism around anywhere. There's very little radicalism. Presumably these kids were brought up by the same book, so I don't think that you can say that my book turns out one kind or the other. I think that it's the social situation and the economic situation that determines political attitudes and political activism.
One of the things I remember during the war, I was teaching in a small college down in Virginia, being at dinner and people talking about Dr. Spock and the permissive Dr. Spock and the whole generation, all that. And I remember having read it and not seeing anything in there that said, oh, let the kids do whatever they want, going back through it and finding that you're pretty stern in many ways.
My book is a very middle-of-the-road kind of a book. It says, respect.